This over, Bosch said. We are on a murder case, sir. We need this information. You know we can get it if we go to the state and federal correctional departments, but that might take longer than your lawyer. We can also get it with a subpoena, but we thought mutual cooperation would be best. We are much more inclined to tread lightly if we have your cooperation. Scales didn't move, and again didn't seem to be listening. A curl of blue smoke swirled like a ghost out of his pipe bowl.
I see, he finally said. Then I'll just get those files, won't I?
He stood up then and went to a row of beige file cabinets that lined the wall behind his desk. He went to one drawer and, after a short search, pulled out a thin manila file. He dropped it on his desk near Bosch.
That's the file on Meadows there, he said. Now let's see what else we can find here.
He went to the first drawer, which had no marking in the card slot on front. He looked through files without taking any out. Then he chose one and sat down with it.
You're free to look through that file, and I can copy anything you need from it, Scales said. This one is my master flow chart of people through here. I can make you a list of any people Meadows could have met here. I assume you'll need DOBs and PINs?
That would help, thank you, Wish said.
It took only 15 minutes to look through Meadows' file. He had started a correspondence with Scales a year before his release from TI. He had the backing of a chaplain and an intake counselor who knew him because he had been assigned to maintenance at the prison's intake and placement office. In one of the letters, Meadows had described the tunnels he had been into in Vietnam and how he had been drawn to their darkness. Most of the other guys were scared to go down there, he wrote. I wanted to go. I didn't know why then, but I think now I was testing my limits. But the fulfillment I received from it was false. I was as hollow as the ground we fought on. The fulfillment I now have is in Jesus Christ, and knowing He is with me. If given the chance, and with His guidance, I can make the right choices this time and leave these bars forever behind. I want to go from hollow ground to hallowed ground.
Tacky, but sincere enough, I guess, Wish said.
Scales looked up from the desk, where he was writing names, birth dates, and prison identification numbers on a sheet of yellow paper.
He was sincere, he said in a voice that suggested there was no other way about it. When Billy Meadows left here, I believed he was ready for the outside, and that he had shed past alliances with drugs and crime. It becomes obvious that he fell back into that temptation. But I doubt you two will find what you're looking for here. I give you these names, but they won't help you.
We'll see, Bosch said. Scales went back to writing, and Bosch watched him. He was too consumed by his faith and loyalty to see he might have been used. Bosch believed Scales was a good man, but one who might be too quick to see his beliefs and hopes in someone else, perhaps someone like Meadows.
Colonel, what do you get out of all this? Bosch asked.
This time he put his pen down, adjusted his pipe in his set jaw, and folded his hands together on the desk.
It's not what I get. It's what the Lord gets.
He picked up the pen again, but then another thought came to him.
You know, these boys were destroyed in many ways when they got back. I know, it's an old story, and everybody's heard it, everybody's seen the movies, but these guys have had to live it. Thousands came back here and literally marched off to the prisons. One day I was reading about that, and I wondered, what if there hadn't been any war, and these boys never went anywhere? They just stayed in Omaha and Los Angeles and Jacksonville and New Iberia and wherever. Would they still have ended up in prison? Would they be hopeless, homeless, wandering mental cases, drug addicts? For most of them, I doubt that. It was the war that did it to them, that sent them the wrong way.
He took a long drag on the dead pipe.
So all I do, with the help of the earth and a few prayer books, is try to put back inside what the Vietnam experience took out. And I'm pretty good at it. So I'm giving you this list, letting you take a look at that file there, but don't hurt what we've got here. You two have a natural suspicion of what goes on here, and that's fine. It's healthy for people in your position, but be careful with what is good here. Detective Bosch, you look the right age. Were you over there?
Bosch nodded, and Scales said, Then you know. He went back to finishing the list. Without looking up, he said, "You two join us for lunch? Freshest vegetables in the county on our table." They declined and stood up to go after Scales handed Bosch the list with the 24 names he had come up with. As Bosch turned to the office door, he hesitated and said, "Colonel, do you mind me asking what other vehicles you have on the farm? I saw the pickup."
"We don't mind you asking, because we have nothing to hide. We got two more pickups like that, two John Deeres and a four-wheel drive vehicle."
"What kind of four-wheel drive vehicle?"
"It's a Jeep."
"And what color?"
"It's white. What's going on?"
"Just trying to clear up something. But I guess the Jeep would have the Charlie Company seal on the side, like the pickup?"
"That's right. All our vehicles are marked. When we go into Ventura, we're proud of what we've accomplished. We want people to know where the vegetables are coming from."
Bosch didn't look at the names on the list until he was in the car. He didn't recognize any, but he noticed that Scales had written the letters PH after 8 of the 24 names.
"What's that mean?"
Wish asked as she leaned over and looked at the list also.
"Purple Heart," Bosch said.
"One more way to say, be careful, I guess."
"What about the Jeep?" she said. "He said it was white. It has a seal on the side."
"You saw how dirty the pickup was. A dirty, white Jeep. It could have looked beige, if it's the right Jeep."
"He just doesn't seem right. Scales, he seems legit."
"Maybe he is. Maybe it's the people he lends his Jeep to. I didn't want to press it with him until we know more."
He started the car, and they headed down the gravel road to the gate. Bosch rolled his window down. The sky was the color of bleached jeans, and the air was invisible and clean, and smelled like fresh green peppers. But not for long, Bosch thought. We go back into the nastiness now. On the way back to the city, Bosch cut off the Ventura Freeway and headed south through Malibu Canyon to the Pacific. It would take longer to get back, but the clean air was addictive. He wanted it for as long as possible. "I want to see the list of the victims," he said, after they had made their way through the winding canyon and the hazy blue surface of the ocean could be seen ahead.
"This pedophile you mentioned earlier, something about that story bothered me. Why would they take the guy's collection of kiddie porno?"
"Harry, come on. You are not going to suggest that was a reason. That these guys tunneled for weeks and then blasted into a bank vault to steal a collection of kiddie porn?"
"Of course not. But that's why it raises the question, why'd they take this stuff?"
"Well, maybe they wanted it. Maybe one was a pedophile and he liked it. Who knows?"
"Or maybe it was all part of a cover. Take everything from every box they drilled to hide the fact that what they were really after was one box. You know, sort of blur the picture by hitting dozens of boxes. But all along, the target was something in only one of the boxes. Same principle with the pawn shop break-in. Take a lot of jewelry to cover they only wanted the bracelet. But with the vault, they wanted something that wouldn't be reported stolen afterward. Something that couldn't be reported stolen because it would get the owner into some kind of jam. Like with the pedophile. When his stuff got stolen, what could he say? That's the sort of thing the tunnelers were after, but something more valuable. Something that would make hitting the safe deposit vault more attractive than hitting the main vault. Something that would make killing Meadows a necessity when he endangered the whole caper by pawning the bracelet."
She was quiet. Bosch looked over at her, but behind her sunglasses she was unreadable.
"Sounds to me like you're talking about drugs again," she said after a while. "And the dog said no drugs. The DEA found no connections on our list of customers."
"Maybe drugs, maybe not. But that's why we should look at the box holders again. I want to look at the list for myself, want to see if anything rings a bell with it. The people who reported no losses, they're the ones that I want to start with."
"I'll get the list. We've got nothing else going anyway."
"Well, we've got these names from Scales to run down," Bosch said. "I was thinking that we'd pull mugs and take them to Sharky."
"Worth a try, I guess. More like just going through the motions."
"I don't know. I think the kid is holding something. I think he maybe saw a face that night."
"I left a memo with Rourke about the hypnosis. He'll probably get back to us on that today or tomorrow."
They took the Pacific Coast Highway around the bay. The smog had been blown inland, and it was clear enough to see Catalina Island out past the Whitecaps. They stopped at Alice's restaurant for lunch, and since it was late, there was an open table by a window. Wish ordered an iced tea, and Bosch had a beer.
I used to come out to this pier when I was a kid, Bosch told her. They'd take a busload of us out. Back then, they had a bait shop out on the end. I'd fish for yellowtail.
Kids from DYS?
Yeah. No. Back then, it was called DPS, Department of Public Services. A few years back, they finally realized they needed a whole department for the kids, so they came up with DYS.
She looked out the restaurant window and down along the pier. She smiled at his memories, and he asked where hers were.
All over, she said. My father was in the military. Most I ever spent in one place was a couple years, so my memories aren't really of places, they're people.
You and your brother were close, Bosch said.
Yes, with my father gone a lot. He was always there, until he enlisted and went away for good.
Salads were put down on the table, and they ate a little bit, and small-talked a little bit, and then sometime between when the waitress picked up the salad plates and put down the lunch plates, she told her brother's story.
Every week he'd write me from over there, and every week he said he was scared, wanted to come home, she said. It wasn't something he could say to our father or mother. But Michael wasn't the type. He should never have gone. He went because of our father. He couldn't let him down. He wasn't brave enough to say no to him, but he was brave enough to go over there. Doesn't make sense. Have you ever heard of anything so dumb?
Bosch didn't answer, because he had heard similar stories, his own included. And she seemed to stop there. She either didn't know what had happened to her brother over there, or didn't want to recount the details. After a while, she said,
Why'd you go?
He knew the question was coming, but in his whole life he had never been able to truthfully answer it, even to himself.
I don't know. No choice, I guess. The institutional life, like you said before. I wasn't going to college. Never really thought about Canada. I think it would have been harder to go there than to just get drafted and go to Vietnam. Then in 68, I sort of won the draft lottery. My number came up so low I knew I was going to go, so I thought I'd outsmart him by joining, thought I'd write my own ticket.
And so?
Bosch laughed a little, in the same phony way she had laughed before. I got in, went through basic and all the bullshit, and when it came time to choose something, I picked the infantry. I still have never figured out why. They get you at that age, you know? You're invincible. Once I got over there, I volunteered for a tunnel squad. It was kind of like that letter Meadows wrote to Scales. You want to see what you've got. You do things you'll never understand. You know what I mean?
I think so, she said. What about Meadows? He had chances to leave, and he never did, not till the very end. Why would anybody want to stay if they didn't have to?
There were a lot like that, Bosch said. I guess it wasn't usual or unusual. Some just didn't want to leave that place. Meadows was one of them. It might have been a business decision, too.
You mean drugs?
Well, I know he was using heroin while he was there. We know he was using and selling afterward when he got back here, so maybe when he was over there he got involved in moving it, and he didn't want to leave a good thing. There's a lot that points to it. He was moved to Saigon after they took him out of the tunnels. Saigon would have been the place to be, especially with embassy clearance like he had as an MP. Saigon was Sin City. Whores, hash, heroin is a free market. A lot of people jumped into it. Heroin would have made him some nice money, especially if he had a plan, a way to move some of the stuff back here.
She pushed pieces of red snapper she wasn't going to eat around on her plate with a fork.
It's unfair, she said. He didn't want to come back. Some boys wanted to come home but never got the chance.
Yes, there was nothing fair about that place.
Bosch turned and looked out the window at the ocean. There were four surfers in bright wetsuits riding on the swells.
And after the war, you joined the cops?
Well, I kicked around a little and then joined the department. It seemed most of the vets I knew, like what Scale said today, were going into the police departments or the penitentiaries.
I don't know, Harry. You seem like the loner type. A private eye, not a man who has to take orders from men he doesn't respect.
There are no more private operators. Everybody takes orders. But all this stuff about me is in the file, you know it all.
Not everything about somebody can be put down on paper. Isn't that what you said?
He smiled as the waitress cleared the table. He said,
What about you? What's your story with the Bureau?
Pretty simple, really. Criminal justice major, accounting minor, recruited out of Penn State. Good pay, good benefits, women highly sought and valued. Nothing original.
Why the bank detail? I thought the fast track was anti-terrorism, white-collar stuff, maybe even drugs, but not the heavy squad.
I did the white-collar stuff for 5 years. I was in D.C., too, the right place to be. The thing is, the Emperor had no clothes. It was all deadly, deadly boring stuff.
She smiled and shook her head.
I realized I just wanted to be a cop. So that's what I became. I transferred to the first good street unit that had an opening. L.A. is the bank robbery capital of the country. When an opening came up here, I called in my markers and got the transfer. Call me a dinosaur if you want.
You're too beautiful for that.
Despite her dark tan, Bosch could tell the remark embarrassed her. It embarrassed him, too, just sort of slipping out like that.
Yeah, sorry, he said.
No. No, that was nice. Thank you.
So, are you married, Eleanor?
He said. And then he turned red, immediately regretting his lack of subtlety. She smiled at his embarrassment.
I was, but it was a long time ago.
Bosch nodded.
You don't have anything... What about Rourke? You two seemed...
What? Are you kidding?
Sorry.
They laughed together then, and followed it with smiles and a long, comfortable silence. After lunch, they walked out on the pier to the spot where Bosch had once stood with rod and reel. There was no one fishing. Several of the buildings at the end of the pier were abandoned. There was a rainbow sheen on top of the water near one of the pylons. Bosch also noticed the surfers were gone. Maybe all the kids are in school, Bosch thought. Or maybe they don't fish here anymore. Maybe no fish make it this far into the poisoned bay.
I haven't been here in a long time, he said to Eleanor.
He leaned on the pier railing, his elbows on wood scarred by 1,000 bait knives.
Things change.
It was mid-afternoon by the time they got back to the federal building. Wish ran the names and prisoner identification numbers Scales had given them through the NCIC and State Department of Justice computers and ordered mugshots, photo facts from various prisons in the state. Bosch took the list of names and called U.S. Military Archives in St. Louis and asked for Jesse St. John, the same clerk he had dealt with on Monday. She said the file on William Meadows that Bosch had asked for was already on the way. Bosch didn't tell her he already had seen the FBI's copy of it. Instead, he talked her into calling up the new names he had on her computer and giving him the basic service biography of each man. He kept her past the end of shift at 5 o'clock in St. Louis, but she said she wanted to help. By 5 o'clock L.A. time, Bosch and Wish had 24 mugshots and brief criminal and military service sketches of the men to go with them. Nothing jumped off Wish's desk and hit either of them over the head. 15 of the men had served in Vietnam at some point during the period Meadows was there. 11 of these were U.S. Army. None were tunnel rats, though 4 were 1st Infantry along with Meadows on his first tour. There were 2 others who were MPOs in Saigon. They focused on the NCIC records of the 6 soldiers who were 1st Infantry or military police. Only the MPOs had bank robbery records. Bosch shuffled through the mugshots and pulled those 2 out. He stared at the faces, half expecting to get confirmation from the hardened, disinterested looks they gave the camera.
I like these 2, he said.
Their names were Art Franklin and Gene Delgado. They both had Los Angeles addresses. In Vietnam, they spent their tours in Saigon assigned to separate MP units, not the embassy unit that Meadows was attached to. But still, they were in the city. Both of them had been discharged in 1973, but as with Meadows, they stayed on in Vietnam as civilian military advisors. They were there until the end, April 1975. There was no question in Bosch's mind. All 3 men, Meadows, Franklin, and Delgado, knew each other before they met at Charlie Company in Ventura County. Stateside, after 1975, Franklin got jammed up on a series of robberies in San Francisco and went away for 5 years. He went down on a federal rap of bank robbery in Oakland in 1984 and was a TI at the same time as Meadows. He was paroled to Charlie Company 2 months before Meadows left the program. Delgado was strictly a state offender. 3 pops for burglaries in L.A., for which he was able to get by on county lockup time, then an attempted bank robbery in Santa Ana in 1985. He was able to plead in state court under an agreement with federal prosecutors. He went up to Soledad, getting out in 1988 and arriving at Charlie Company 3 months ahead of Meadows. He left Charlie Company a day after Franklin arrived.
"One day," Wish said. "This means all three were together there at Charlie Company only 1 day?"
Bosch looked at their photos and the accompanying descriptions. Franklin was the larger one, 6 foot, 190, dark hair. Delgado was lean, 5'6", and 140, dark hair, too. Bosch stared at the photos of the big man and the small man, and was thinking about the descriptions of the men in the jeep that had dumped Meadows' body. "Let's go see Sharkey," he said after a while. He called Home Street Home and was told what he knew they were going to tell him. Sharkey was gone. Bosch tried the Blue Chateau, and a tired old voice told him that Sharkey's crew had moved out at noon. His mother hung up on Bosch after she determined he was not a customer. It was near 7. Bosch told Wish they would have to go back to the street to find him. She said she'd drive. They spent the next 2 hours in West Hollywood, mostly in the Santa Monica Boulevard corridor. But there was no sign of Sharkey or his motorbike locked to a parking meter. They flagged down a few sheriff's cruisers and told them who they were looking for, but not even the extra eyes helped. They parked at the curb by the Okie Dog, and Bosch was thinking that maybe the boy had gone back to his mother's house and she had hung up the phone to protect him. "You want to take a ride up to Chatsworth?" he asked.
"As much as I'd like to see this witch you told me Sharkey has for a mother, I was thinking more along the lines of calling it a day. We can find Sharkey tomorrow. How about that dinner we didn't have last night?"
Bosch wanted to get to Sharkey, but he also wanted to get to her. She was right. There was always tomorrow.
"Sounds good to me," he said. "Where you feel like going?"
"My place."
Eleanor Wish lived in a rent-controlled townhouse she subleased 2 blocks from the beach in Santa Monica. They parked at the curb in front, and as they went in, she told Bosch that although she lived close by, if he wanted to actually see the ocean, he had to walk out onto her bedroom balcony, lean over, and look sharply to the right down Ocean Park Boulevard. A slice of the Pacific could then be seen between 2 condominium towers that guarded the shoreline. From that angle, she mentioned, he could also see into her next-door neighbor's bedroom. The neighbor was a has-been television actor turned small-time dope dealer who had a never-ending procession of women through the bedroom. It kind of took away from the view, she said. She told Bosch to have a seat in the living room while she got dinner started.
"If you like jazz, I have a CD over there I just bought but haven't had time to listen to," she said.
He walked over to the stereo, which was stacked on shelves next to a set of bookcases, and picked up the new disc. It was Rollins, Falling in Love with Jazz, and inside Harry smiled because he had it at home. It was a warm connection. He opened the case, put the music on, and began to look around the living room. There were pastel throw rugs and light-colored coverings on the furniture. Architectural books and home magazines were spread on a glass-topped coffee table in front of a light blue couch. The place was very neat. A framed cross-stitch canvas on the wall next to the front door said, "Welcome to this home." Small letters stitched in its corner said, "EDS 1970, and Bosch wondered about the last letter. He made another one of those psychic connections with Eleanor Wish when he turned around and looked at the wall above the couch. Framed in black wood was a print of Edward Hopper's Nighthawks. Bosch didn't have the print at home, but he was familiar with the painting, and from time to time even thought about it when he was deep on a case or on a surveillance. He had seen the original in Chicago once, and had stood in front of it, studying it for nearly an hour. A quiet, shadowy man sits alone at the counter of a street-front diner. He looks across at another customer, much like himself, but only the second man is with a woman. Somehow, Bosch identified with it, with that first man.
I am the loner, he thought. I am the Nighthawk. The print, with its stark, dark hues and shadows, did not fit in this apartment, Bosch realized. Its darkness clashed with the pastels. Why did Eleanor have it? What did she see there? He looked around the rest of the room. There was no TV. There was just the music on the stereo, and the magazines on the table, and the books on the lawyer's shelves against the wall across from the couch. He stepped over and looked through the glass panes and browsed the collection. The top two shelves were mostly highbrow book-of-the-month offerings, descending into crime fiction by writers like Crumley and Williford and others. He had read some of them. He opened the glass door and pulled out a book called The Locked Door. He'd heard of the book, but had never seen it to buy. He opened the cover to see how old it was, and he solved the mystery of the last letter on the needlework. On the first page, printed in ink, it said, Eleanor D. Scarletti, 1979. She must have kept her husband's name after the divorce, Bosch thought. He put the book back and closed the case. The books on the bottom two rows of the bookcase ranged from true crime to historical studies of the Vietnam War to FBI manuals. There was even an LAPD homicide investigation textbook. Many of these books Bosch had read. One of them he was even in. It was a book the Times reporter Bremer had written about the so-called beauty shop slasher. A guy named Harvard Kendall, the slasher, killed 7 women in 1 year in the San Fernando Valley. They were all beauty shop owners or employees. He cased the shops, followed the victims home, and killed them by cutting their throats with a sharpened nail file. Bosch and his partner at the time connected Kendall through a license plate number the 7th victim had written on a pad in the salon the night before she was murdered. They never figured out why she had done it, but the detective suspected she had seen Kendall watching the shop from his van. She wrote the tag number down as a precaution, but then didn't take the precaution of not going home alone. Bosch and his partner traced the tag to Kendall and found out he had spent 5 years in Folsom for a series of beauty shop arsons near Oakland in the 1960s. They later discovered his mother had worked as a manicurist in a beauty shop when he was a boy. She had practiced her craft on young Kendall's nails, and the shrinks figured he never got over it. Bremer had gotten a bestseller out of it, and when Universal made a movie of the week out of it, the studio paid Bosch and his partner for the use of their names and technical assistance. The money doubled when a cop series spun off the movie. His partner quit the department and moved to Ensenada. Bosch stayed on, investing his stake in the Stilt House on the hill that looked down on the studio that paid him the money. Bosch always found an unexplainable symbiosis in that.
I read that book before your name ever came up in this. It wasn't part of the research.
Eleanor had come out of the kitchen with 2 glasses of red wine. Harry smiled. I wasn't going to accuse you of anything, he said. Besides, it isn't about me, it's about Kendall. The whole thing was luck, anyway. But they still made a book and TV show about it. You know, whatever it is in there, it smells good.
You like pasta?
I like spaghetti.
That's what we're having. I made a big pot of sauce Sunday. I love to spend an entire day in the kitchen not thinking about anything else. I find it's good therapy for stress. And it lasts and lasts. All I have to do is warm it up and boil some noodles.
Bosch sipped his wine and looked around some more. He still hadn't sat down, but was feeling very comfortable with her. A smile played across his face. He gestured toward the Hopper print. I like it, but why something so dark? She looked at the print and crinkled her brow as if this were the first time she had considered it.
I don't know, she said. I've always liked that painting. Something there grabs me. The woman is with a man, so that isn't me. So I guess if it's anyone, it would be the man sitting with his coffee, all alone, kind of watching the two that are together.
I saw it in Chicago once, Bosch said. The original? I was out there in an extradition and had about an hour to kill until I could pick up the body, so I went into the Art Institute and it was there. I spent the whole hour looking at it. There's something about it, like you said. I can't remember the case or who I was bringing back here, but I remember that painting. They sat at the table talking for nearly an hour after the food was gone. She told him more about her brother and her difficulty getting over the anger and loss. 18 years later, she was still working it out, she said.
Bosch told her that he was still working things out, too. He still dreamed of the tunnels from time to time, but more often he battled insomnia instead. He told her how mixed up he was when he got back, how thin the line was, the choice between what he had done afterward and what Meadows did. It could have been different, he said, and she nodded, seeming to know that was true. Later, she asked about the Dollmaker case and his fall from robbery-homicide. It was more than curiosity. He sensed that something important rode on what he told her. She was making a decision about him. "I guess you know the basics," he began. "Somebody was strangling women, mostly prostitutes, then painting over their faces with makeup. Pancake, red lipstick, heavy rouge on the cheeks, sharp black eyeliner. The same thing every time. The bodies were bathed, too, but we never said it looked like he was making them into dolls. Some asshole, I think it was a guy named Sakai over at the coroner's, leaked that the makeup was the common denominator. Then this dollmaker stuff started playing in the press. I think Channel 4 was the first to come up with that name. It took off from there. To me, it looked more like a mortician's work. But the truth is, we weren't doing too good. We didn't have a handle on the guy until he was in the double figures. Not much physical evidence. The victims were all dumped in random locations all over the west side. We knew from fiber evidence on a couple of the bodies that the guy probably wore a rug or some kind of hair disguise, fake beard or something. The women that were taken off the stroll, we were able to isolate times and places of their last trick. We went to the hourly motels, got nothing. So we figured the guy was picking them up in a car and then taking them somewhere else, maybe to his home or some kind of safe place he used as a killing pad. We started watching the boulevard and other hot spots the pros work, and we must have busted up 300 tricks before we got the break. This whore, name of Dixie McQueen, calls up the task force one morning, early, and says she just escaped from the dollmaker, and is there a reward if she gives him up? Well, we were getting calls like that every week. I mean, 11 murdered women and people are coming out of the woodwork with clues that aren't really clues. It's Panic City.
I remember,
Wish said. But Dixie was different. I was working the late shift in the task force offices that day, and I caught the call. I went and talked to her. She told me that this John she'd picked up on Hollywood near Spa Row, you know, near the Scientology mansion, took her to this garage apartment in Silver Lake. She said that while the guy was getting naked, she wanted to use the toilet. So she goes in, and while she's running the water, she looks through the cabinet below the sink, probably to see if there's anything worth lifting. But she sees all these little bottles and compacts and all this women's stuff. She looks at it all and she just puts it all together, just like that. Bingo, this has to be the guy. So she gets a case of Total Creeps and bails out. She comes out of the bathroom and the guy's in bed. She just hauls ass through the front door. The thing is, we hadn't put out all the stuff about the makeup. Or actually, the asshole that was the media leak didn't put out everything. See, we knew that the guy was keeping the victim's stuff. They were found with their purses, but there were no cosmetics. You know, lipstick, compacts, things like that. So when Dixie told me about what was in the bathroom cabinet, she got my attention. I knew she was legit. And that is the point where I screwed up. It was 3 a.m. by the time I was done talking to Dixie. Everybody on the task force had gone home, and I was left there thinking that this guy might realize Dixie made him and clear out. So I went there alone. I mean, Dixie went with me to show me the place, but then she never left the car. Once we were there, I saw a light on above the garage, which was behind this run-down house off of Hyperion. I called for patrol backup, and while I'm waiting, I see the guy's shadow going back and forth across the window. Something tells me he's getting ready to bug out and take all the stuff from the cabinet with him. And we had no evidence from the 11 bodies. We needed the stuff that was in the bathroom cabinet. The other consideration was, what if he has someone up there? You know, a replacement for Dixie. So I went up, alone. You know the rest. Wish said,
You went in without a warrant and shot him when he was reaching under the pillow on the bed. You later told the shooting team that you believed it was an emergency situation. There had been enough time for him to go out and get another prostitute. You said that gave you the authority to come through the door without a warrant. You said you fired because you believed the suspect was reaching for a weapon. It was one shot, upper torso, from 15 or 20 feet, if I remember the report. But the dollmaker was alone, and under the pillow was only his toupee.
Only his rug, Bosch said. He shook his head like a Monday morning quarterback. The shooting team cleared me. We connected him to two of the bodies through the hair from the toupee, and the makeup in the bathroom was traced to eight of the victims. There was no doubt it was him. I was clear, but then the shoe fly started in on it, a Lewis and Clark expedition. They ran down Dixie and got her to sign a statement saying she told me beforehand that he put his hair under the pillow. I don't know what they used against her, but I can imagine. IADs always had a hard-on for me. They don't like anybody who's not 100% part of the family. Anyway, the next thing I know, they're bringing departmental charges against me. They wanted to fire me and take Dixie to a grand jury to get criminal charges. It was like there was blood in the water and two fat white sharks. He stopped there, but Eleanor continued.
The IAD detectives misjudged things, though, Harry. They didn't realize that public opinion would be with you. You were known in the newspapers as the cop who broke the beauty shop slasher and doll maker cases, a character in a TV show. They couldn't take you down without a lot of public scrutiny and embarrassment for the department.
Someone reached down from above them and put a stop to the grand jury move, Bosch said. They had to settle for a suspension and my demotion to Hollywood homicide. Bosch had his fingers on the stem of his empty wine glass and was absent-mindedly turning the glass on the table. Some settlement, he said after a while. And those two IAD sharks are still swimming around out there waiting for the kill. They sat silently for a while then. He was waiting for her to ask the question she had asked once before. Had the whore lied? She never asked it. And after a while she just looked at him and smiled. And he felt as if he had just passed the test. She started gathering the plates off the table. Bosch helped her in the kitchen, and when the work was done they stood close, drying their hands on the same dish towel, and lightly kissed. Then, as if following the same secret signals, they pressed themselves against each other and kissed with the kind of hunger lonely people have.
I want to stay, Bosch said after momentarily breaking away.
I want you to stay, she said.
Arson's stoned eyes were shiny and reflected the neon night. He sucked hard on the cool and held the precious smoke in. The cigarette had been dipped in PCP. A smile cracked across his face as the jet streams of smoke escaped his nostrils. He said,
"You're the only shark I ever heard of being used as bait. Get it?"
He laughed and took another deep drag before handing the cigarette to Sharky, who waved it away because he'd had enough. Mojo took it then.
"Yeah, I'm getting tired of this shit," Sharky said. "You take a turn for once."
"Chill out, man. You're the only one can get away with it, man. Mojo and me, man, we just don't play the part good as you. Besides, we got our part. You ain't big enough to pound these faggots."
"Well, why don't we do the 7-Eleven again?" Sharky said. "I don't like this not knowing who it is. I like it at the 7-Eleven. We pick our meat. They don't pick me."
"No way," Mojo spoke up then. "We go back there. We don't know if that last guy reported it to the sheriffs or not. We have to stay clear there a while. They're probably watching the place from the same parking lot we did."
Sharky knew they were right. He just thought that being out on Santa Monica on the queer stroll was getting too close to the real thing. Next thing, he guessed, the two dopers will not feel like charging in. They'll want him to go through with it, get the money that way. That was when he would split these guys, he knew.
"Okay,"
he said, stepping off the curb.
"Don't fuck me up."
He started to cross the street. Arson yelled after him,
"BMW or better."
As if I need to be told, Sharky thought. He walked a half block toward La Brea and then leaned against the door of a closed print shop. He was still a half block from Hot Rods, an adult bookstore that offered 25-cent all-male peeps, but he was close enough to catch the eye of somebody walking out, if the eye was looking. He looked back the other way and saw the glow of the joint in the darkness of the driveway where Arson and Mojo sat on their bikes. Sharky hadn't been standing there 10 minutes when a car, a new Grand Am, pulled to the curb and the electric window glided down. Sharky was going to blow this one off, remembering BMW or better, until he saw the glint of gold and stepped closer. His adrenaline kicked up a notch. The wrist the driver had draped over the steering wheel was adorned with a Rolex Presidential. If it was real, Arson knew where they could get $3,000 for it, a grand apiece, not to mention what else the meat might have at home or in his wallet. Sharkey looked the man over. The guy looked like a straight, a businessman. Dark hair, dark suit, mid-40s, not too big. Sharkey might even be able to take him alone. The man smiled at Sharkey and said,
"Hey, how you doing?"
"Not bad. What's up?"
"Oh, I don't know, just out for a ride. You want to take a ride?"
"Where to?"
"No place special. I know a place we can go be alone."
"You got $100 on you?"
"No, but I got $50 for night baseball."
"Pitching or catching?"
"Oh, I'm a pitcher, and I brought my own glove."
Sharkey hesitated and glanced toward the driveway where he had seen the glow from the cool. It was gone now. They must be ready to move. He looked back at the watch.
"That's cool,"
he said, and got in the car. The car headed west, past the alley driveway. Sharkey held himself from looking, but he thought he heard the revving and popping sound of their bikes. They were following.
"Where are we going?"
he asked.
I can't go home with you, my friend. But I know a place we can go. Nobody will bother us."
"Cool."
They stopped at the light at Flores, which made Sharkey think of the guy from the other night. They were near his place. Arson was hitting harder, it seemed. This would have to stop soon, or they would kill someone. He hoped the man with the Rolex would give it up peaceably. There was no telling what those two would do. Stoked on PCP, they would be ready for battle and blood. Suddenly, the car lurched through the intersection. Sharkey noticed the light was still red.
"What's going on?" he said sharply.
"Nothing. I'm tired of waiting, is all."
Sharkey thought there would be nothing suspicious about looking back now. He turned and saw only cars waiting back at the intersection. No motorbikes. Those bastards, he thought. He felt a dampness beginning on his scalp and the first tremblings of fear. The car turned right after Barney's Beanery and up the hill to Sunset. Then they went east to Highland, and the man with the Rolex steered north again.
"Have we been together before?"
the man asked. "You seem familiar."
"I don't know. Maybe we've just seen each other around." "No, I've never... I don't think so."
"Look at me."
"What?"
Sharkey said, startled by the question and the man's sharp tone.
"Why?"
"Look at me. You know me? Have you seen me before?"
"What is this, a credit card commercial?" "I said no, man."
The man turned the car off the street into the east parking lot of the Hollywood Bowl. It was deserted. He drove quickly and without saying another word to the darkened north end. Sharkey thought, if this is your quiet little spot, then that ain't no real Rolex you got on your wrist, pal.
"Hey, what are we doing, man?"
Sharkey said. He was thinking of a way to bail out of this. He was pretty sure Arson and Mojo, stoned as they were lost. He was alone with this guy, and he wanted to scratch it.
"The bowl is closed," Rolex said, "but I got a key to the dressing room, see? We just take the tunnel under Cahuenga, and then near where it comes up, there's a little walkway we back around. There won't be anyone around. I work there, I know."
For a moment, Sharkey considered trying to take the guy alone, then decided he couldn't do it. Unless there was a way of taking him by surprise, he would see. The man turned the car engine off and opened his door. Sharkey opened his own door, got out, and looked across the dark expanse of the empty parking lot. He was looking for the two lights of the motorbikes, but there weren't any. "I'll take this guy out on the other side," he decided. He would make his move, either hit and run, or just run. They headed toward the sign that said, "Pedestrian Expressway." There was a concrete outbuilding with an open doorway, and then stairs. As they walked down the whitewashed steps, the man with the Rolex put his hand on Sharkey's shoulder and then clamped it on the back of his neck in a fatherly manner. Sharkey could feel the cold metal of the watch's wristband. The man said,
"You sure we don't know each other, Sharkey?
Maybe seen each other?"
"No, man, I'm telling you, I haven't been with you."
They were about halfway through the tunnel when Sharkey realized he hadn't told the man his name. Part 5, Thursday, May 24th. It had been a long time for him, and in Eleanor's bedroom, Harry Bosch was clumsy in the way of a man who was overly self-conscious and out of practice. As with most first times he had had, it wasn't good. She directed him with her hands and whispers, and afterward he felt like apologizing, but didn't. They held each other and lightly dozed, the smell of her hair in his face, the same apple scent he had encountered in his kitchen the night before. Bosch was infatuated with her and wanted to breathe the smell of her hair every minute. After a while, he kissed her awake, and they made love again. This time he needed no directions, and she didn't need her hands. When they were done, Eleanor whispered to him,
"Do you think you can be alone in this world and not be lonely?"
He didn't answer at first, and she said,
"Are you alone, or are you lonely, Harry Bosch?"
He thought about that for some time while her fingers gently traced the tattoo on his shoulder.
"I don't know what I am," he finally whispered. "You get so used to things the way they are. And I've always been alone. I guess that makes me lonely. Until now."
They smiled in the dark and kissed, and soon he heard her deep, sleeping breaths. Much later, Bosch got up from the bed, pulled on his pants, and went out on the balcony to smoke. On Ocean Park Boulevard there was no traffic, and he could hear the ocean's noise from nearby. The lights were out in the apartment next door. They were out everywhere except on the street. He could see that the jacaranda trees along the sidewalk were shedding their flowers. They had fallen like a violet snow on the ground, and the cars parked along the curb. Bosch leaned on the railing and blew smoke into the cool night wind. When he was on his second cigarette, he heard the door behind him slide open, and then felt her hands come around his waist as she embraced him from behind.
"What's wrong, Harry?"
"Nothing. Just thinking." "You better watch out. Carcinogen alert. You ever heard of the draft risk easement?"
"Assessment, Harry, not easement. What are you thinking about? Is this how it is most nights for you?"
Bosch turned around in her arms and kissed her forehead. She was wearing a short robe of pink silk. He rubbed his thumb up and down the nape of her neck.
"Almost no night is like this. I just couldn't sleep. I guess I was thinking about a lot of things."
"About us?"
She kissed his chin.
"I guess."
"And?"
He brought his hand around to her face and traced the outline of her jaw with his fingers.
"I was wondering how you got this little scar here."
"Oh, that is from when I was a girl. My brother and I, we were riding on a bike and I was on the handlebars. And we went down this hill. It was called Highland Avenue. This was when we lived in Pennsylvania. And he lost control. The bike started weaving and I was so scared because I knew we were going to crash. And just as he really lost it and we were going down, he yelled, 'Ellie, you'll be all right.' Just like that. And because he had yelled that, he was right. I cut my chin, but I didn't even cry. I always thought that was something, that he would try to yell something to me rather than worry about himself at a moment like that. But that was my brother."
Bosch dropped his hands from her face. He said, "I was also thinking that what happened between us was nice."
"I think so too, Harry. Nice for a couple of nighthawks. Come back to bed now."
They went back in. Bosch first went into the bathroom and used his finger as a toothbrush, and then crawled back under the sheet with her. The blue glow of a digital clock on the bed table said 2:26, and Bosch closed his eyes. When he opened them again, the clock said 3:46, and there was an obnoxious chirping sound coming from somewhere in the room. He realized he was not in his own room. Then he remembered he was in Eleanor Wish's room. As he finally got oriented, he saw her shadowy figure stooped next to the bed, her hands going through the pile of his clothes.
"Where is it?" she said. "I can't find it."
Bosch reached for his pants, traced his hands along the belt until he found the pager, and turned it off without having to fumble with it. He had done it many times in the dark before.
"Jesus," she said. "That was rude."
Bosch swung his legs over the side of the bed, gathered the sheet around his waist, and sat up. He yawned and then warned her that he was going to turn on the light. She said, "Go ahead." And when the light came on, it hit him like a diamond burst between his eyes. When his vision cleared, she was standing in front of him naked, looking down at the digital readout of the pager in his hand. Bosch finally looked down at the number, but didn't recognize it. He wiped a hand across his face and rustled his hair. There was a telephone on the bed table, and he pulled it onto his lap. He dialed the number and then fumbled with his hands in his clothes for a cigarette, which he put in his mouth but didn't light. Eleanor noticed her nakedness and walked over to a lounge chair to get her robe. After it was on, she went into the bathroom and closed the door. Bosch heard water running. The other end of the line was picked up halfway through the first ring. Jerry Edgar didn't answer with a hello, just,
"Harry, where are you at?"
"I'm not home. What is it?"
"This kid you were looking for, the one on the 911 call. You found him, right?"
"Yeah, but we're looking for him again."
"Who's we? You and the Phoebe woman?"
Eleanor came out of the bathroom and sat down on the edge of the bed next to him.
"Jerry, what are you calling me for?"
Bosch asked. He was beginning to get a sinking feeling in his chest.
"What's the kid's name?"
Bosch was in a daze. It had been months since he had fallen so deeply asleep, only to be rousted out of it. He couldn't remember Sharkey's real name, and he didn't want to ask Eleanor because Edgar might hear and then know they were together. Harry looked at Eleanor, and when she began to speak, he touched his finger to her lips and shook his head.
"Is it Edward Neese? That the kid's name?"
The sinking feeling was gone. Bosch felt an invisible fist pressing up under his ribs and into the folds of his guts and heart.
"Right," he said. "That's the name."
"You gave him one of your business cards?"
"Right."
"Harry, you aren't looking for him anymore."
"Tell me about it."
"Come on out and see for yourself. I'm over at the Bowl. Sharky's in the pedestrian tunnel under Cahuenga. Park on the east side. You'll see the cars."
The Hollywood Bowl's east parking lot was supposed to be empty at 4:30 a.m., but as Bosch and Wish drove up Highland to the mouth of the Cahuenga Pass, they saw that the north end of the lot was crowded with the usual grouping of official cars and vans that signal the violent, or at least unexpected, end of a life. There was yellow plastic crime scene tape strung in a square, boxing the entrance to the stairwell that went down to the pedestrian underpass. Bosch flashed his badge and gave his name to a uniform cop who was keeping the officers on the scene list on a clipboard. He and Wish ducked under the tape and were met by the loud sound of an engine echoing from the mouth of the tunnel. Bosch knew by the sound that it was a generator making the juice for the crime scene lights. At the top step, before they began their descent, he turned to Eleanor and said,
"You want to wait here? We don't both have to go."
"I'm a cop, for God's sake," she said. "I've seen bodies before. You going to get protective of me now, Bosch? Tell you what, want me to go down and you stay up here?"
Startled by her abrupt change in mood, Bosch didn't answer. He looked at her a moment longer, confused. He started down a few steps in front of her, but stopped when he saw Edgar's large body come out of the tunnel and start up the steps. Edgar saw Bosch, and then Bosch saw his eyes go over his shoulder and take Eleanor Wish in.
"Hey, Harry," he said. "This your new partner? You must be getting along real fine already."
Bosch just stared at him. Eleanor was still three steps behind and probably hadn't heard the remark.
"Sorry, Harry," Edgar said, just loud enough to be heard over the roar from the tunnel. "Out of line. Been a bad night. You should see who I got for a new partner. The useless fuck 98 pounds stuck me with."
"I thought you were going to get..."
"Nope. Get this. Pounds put me with Porter from Autos. The guy's a burned-out lush."
"I know. How'd you even get him out of bed for this?"
"He wasn't in bed. I had to track him down at the Parrot up in North Hollywood. It's one of them private bottle clubs. Porter gives me the number when we're first introduced as partners and tells me that's where he'll be most nights. Tells me he works a security detail there. But I called the off-duty assignments officer at Parker Center to check it out, and they got no record. I know the only thing he does there is booze. He must have been practically passed out when I called. The bartender said the pager on his belt went off, but he didn't even hear it. Harry, I think the guy could blow a .2 right now if we put a breathalyzer on him."
Bosch nodded and frowned the required 3 seconds, and then put Jerry Edgar's troubles aside. He felt Eleanor step down beside him, and he introduced her to Edgar. They shook hands and smiled, and Bosch said,
"So, what have we got?" "Well, we got these on the body," Edgar said, and he held up a clear plastic bag. There was a short stack of Polaroids in it, more nude shots of Sharky.
He hadn't wasted any time resupplying. Edgar turned the bag, and there was Bosch's business card. "It looks like the kid was a hustler down in Boytown," Edgar said. "But if you already pulled him in once, you already know that. Anyway, I saw the card and figured he might be the kid from the 911 call. If you want to come down and take a look, be my guest. We already processed the scene, so touch whatever you want. You can't hear yourself thinking there, though. Somebody went through and knocked out every light in the tunnel. Haven't figured out whether that was the perp or the lights were knocked out before. Anyway, we had to set up our own, and our cables weren't long enough to put the generator up here. It's in there, screaming like a 5-horsepower baby." He turned to head back into the tunnel, but Bosch reached out and touched his shoulder. "Jed, how'd you get the call on this?"
"Anonymous. It wasn't a 911 line, so there's no tape or trace. Came in right to the Hollywood desk. Caller was a male, that's all the dipshit. One of those fat explorer kids who took it could tell us."
Edgar turned back into the subway. Bosch and Wish followed. It was a long hallway that curved to the right. The floor was dirty concrete. Its walls were white stucco with a heavy overlay of graffiti. Nothing like a dose of urban reality as you're leaving the Symphony at the Bowl, Bosch thought. The tunnel was dark except for the bright splash of light that bathed the crime scene about halfway in. There, Bosch could see a human form sprawled on its back. Sharky. He could see men standing and working in the light. Bosch walked with the fingers of his right hand trailing along the stuccoed wall. It steadied him. There was an old, damp smell in the tunnel that was mixed with the new odor of gasoline and exhaust from the generator. Bosch felt beads of sweat start to form on his scalp and under his shirt. His breathing was fast and shallow. They passed the generator 30 feet in, and in another 30 feet or so, Sharky was lying on the tunnel floor under the brutal light of the strobes. The boy's head was propped against the tunnel wall at an unnatural angle. He seemed smaller and younger than Bosch remembered him. His eyes were half open and had the familiar glaze of the unseeing on them. He wore a black T-shirt that said Guns and Roses on it, and it was matted with his blood. The pockets of his faded jeans were pulled out and empty. At his side stood a can of spray paint and a plastic evidence bag. On the wall above his head, a painted inscription read, R.I.P. Sharky. The paint had been applied with an inexperienced hand, and too much had been used. Black paint had run down the wall in thin lines, some of them into Sharky's hair. When Edgar yelled, "You want to see it?" above the din of the generator, Bosch knew that he meant the wound. Because Sharky's head was angled forward, the throat wound was not visible, only the blood. Bosch shook his head no. Bosch noticed the blood splatter on the wall and floor about 3 feet from the body. Porter, the lush, was comparing the shapes of the drops with those on splatter cards and a steel ring. A crime scene tech named Roberge was also photographing the spots. The blood on the floor was in round spots. The wall splatter drops were elliptical. You didn't need splatter cards to know the kid had been killed right here in the tunnel.
"The way it's looking," Porter said loudly to no one in particular, "somebody comes up behind him here, cuts him, and pushes him down against the wall there."
"You only got it half right, Porter," Edgar said. "How's somebody come up behind somebody in a tunnel like this? He was with somebody, and they did him. It was no sneak job, Porter."
Porter put the splatter cards in his pocket and said,
"Sorry, partner."
He didn't say anything else. He was fat and broken down, the way many cops get when they stay on longer than they should. Porter could still wear a size 34 belt, but above it, a tremendous gut bloomed outward like an awning. He wore a tweed sport coat with a frayed elbow. His face was gaunt and as pallid as a flour tortilla, behind a drinker's nose that was large, misshapen, and painfully red. Bosch lit a cigarette and put the burnt match in his pocket. He crouched down like a baseball catcher next to the body and lifted the bag containing the paint can and hefted it. It was almost full, and that confirmed what he already knew, already feared. It was he who had killed Sharky. In a way, at least. Bosch had tracked him down and made him valuable, or potentially valuable, to the case. Someone could not allow this. Bosch squatted there, elbows on knees, holding cigarette to mouth, smoking and studying the body, making sure he would not